like what one often hears when you hear this "we're not the arbiters of truth" response from some of the platforms is what they mean by that is they don't see themselves, they don't want to be defined as traditional media companies or as publishers.
I'm Quinta Jurasek, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 31st, 2019. Today, we're bringing you the first episode in a special series that will be running in the lead-up to the 2020 election about disinformation and online speech. From Russian election interference to scandals over privacy and invasive ad targeting to presidential tweets, it's all happening in online spaces governed by private social media companies. And as the 2020 presidential election draws nearer, these conflicts are only going to grow in importance. In this series, my colleagues Evelyn Dweck, Kate Klonick, Alina Polyakova, and I will be talking to experts and practitioners about the major challenges our new information ecosystem poses for elections and democracy in general, and the danger of finding cures that are worse than the disease. We're calling the series Arbiters of Truth, a reference to something Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg said right after the 2016 election, when Facebook was still reeling from accusations that it hadn't done enough to clamp down on disinformation. Zuckerberg wrote that social media platforms must be extremely cautious about becoming arbiters of truth ourselves. Well, if Facebook doesn't want to be the arbiter of truth, we're here to do it for them. Today, in the first episode, my co-hosts and I sat down to talk about our work on disinformation and the main questions they hope to answer in this podcast over the coming months. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 466, Introducing the Arbiters of Truth. Let's start off just by going around the virtual table and introducing ourselves. I'll start off. I'm Quinta Jurasek. I'm the managing editor of Lawfare.
I'm Alina Polyakova. I'm director for the project on global democracy and emerging technologies within the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution. And I've been working on disinformation in its various forms, primarily since the Maidan protests in Ukraine, but even before that, trying to understand the toolkit of Russian influence operations against places like Ukraine and now more broadly against the West.
I'm Evelyn Dweck, a Lawfare contributor and doctoral student at Harvard Law School, studying broadly online speech issues.
My name is Kate Klonick, and I'm an assistant professor at St. John's Law School in New York. And I have studied for the last couple of years online governance and online speech and how private companies influence our democracy and online speech.
All right, great. So I think what makes sense is to start off on just the most basic possible of questions, which is, what is disinformation? So Alina, I'll toss that over to you. How would you define it?
Yeah, I'm actually curious because I wonder if we'll all settle on the same definition, which I think will probably signal that we're still very much in the early stages in our societies of trying to really understand where we find ourselves in the information ecosystem. But I do think it's important to distinguish disinformation from misinformation, for example, or just fake news. Fake news has become a term for news I don't like. So anything that somebody doesn't like, now we colloquially call it fake news. Misinformation is inaccurate information that is not necessarily shared maliciously. It may be, you know, silly videos that your crazy uncle shares, but obviously, or hopefully, your crazy uncle is not a covert Russian agent trying to intentionally manipulate you in various ways. So disinformation, as I already previewed, to my mind, really focuses on the notion of malicious intent. It is the intentional spread of false or misleading content, narratives, information that aims to specifically influence, manipulate, exploit, mislead certain audiences.
Right. And I mean, complicating that even further is, how do you distinguish malicious disinformation, which you sort of just said, like coordinated activities to try and influence discourse, from just regular political campaigning, which often is coordinated, selectively edited, or, you know, attack ads and things like that. Obviously, they are different, but finding a way to draw the lines in a way that isn't politically fraught is also extremely difficult.
I think that gets to something that I've noticed has become more and more prominent in recent months, which is really the way that this sort of rallying cry of censorship in response to the way that internet platforms have tried to respond to disinformation has become sort of a political rallying cry along different points of the political spectrum. I think we see this from the president, obviously, most prominently now, sort of saying, you know, if a platform doesn't help promote or prevents to some extent the dissemination of information, President Trump and his supporters will often say, you know, this is censorship. They're preventing the free flow of ideas. And then the counterargument is, well, you know, this is disinformation. It's, you know, literally it is fake news. It is not accurate.
Yeah. One of the earliest things that I thought was really frustrating is that when people were talking about fake news following the 2016 election, there certainly wasn't the distinction that Alina is making between with intent, but there also was no distinction made between just things that acted like spam. I think that that's actually a really helpful way to think about some, I guess the term that we are using is misinformation, because it turns out that's exactly how private companies deal with it. You can kind of recognize it in the same way as you can see how it's posted, where it's posted, when it's posted, how much it's posted, and that type of thing. And they can launch a lot of the same attacks. Misinformation is a lot more difficult. There's also a lot of disagreement about what is malicious and what isn't, and what is true and what isn't. And so I think that that's the hard place that these platforms find themselves at now.
So I think this might be a good opportunity to dig into the name of our podcast, Arbiters of Truth, and where that comes from, because that follows on from what you were just saying, Kate, is when there's these calls.
Is it because I'm the arbiter of truth?
Exactly.
That's right. We have answered the question. All of this problem goes away if we just put Kate in charge of everything. No. So often platforms' response when they get criticism for not doing more about disinformation, misinformation, fake news, all of it, is we don't want to become the arbiters of truth. And I mean, I have a similar response to you, Kate. Why not? It sounds awesome. But what is behind that? Why are they so reluctant to take on this role?
There's no win for them in this, right? Like, that's really how you have to think about it. Anything that they do, whether they keep the information up or they take it down, they're going to piss someone off. And getting into the business of making these hard decisions is not only really hard to do at scale, which, you know, you have to ask yourself, I think, the question of, like, if something is hard to do at scale, should you be doing it at all? But I think we're almost, that ship has sailed. And that I think that that's their main thing. There's no win for them reputationally. And when I say reputationally, I think that you have to think of these platforms as operating not for some, like, it's not that any one post, for example, gives them like dollars in their pocket. That's not what they're thinking when they make these kinds of individual content choices. You really have to think about it as it makes them, whether or not it creates a PR disaster for them. And then if it creates a PR disaster, it decreases their cultural relevancy. And, you know, then you get into traditional notions of kind of exit voice loyalty. People get angry at them. People leave the platform. People stay in the platform. People go to other platforms. And so those affect their bottom line, not the content themselves. And so they want to make the most people happy. And like, they're never going to be able to make people, the most people happy, if they're the ones making these really hard choices.
Yeah. And just to add on that, I think what one often hears when you hear this, we're not the arbiters of truth response from some of the platforms, is what they mean by that is they don't see themselves, they don't want to be defined as traditional media companies or as publishers. They're platforms, meaning it's a digital space for users, individuals, groups to share content. And they provide that as a service. That, again, is the argument that you often hear. So it should not be their responsibility to decide. It's the user's responsibility, or perhaps it's the public policy's responsibility to decide what constitutes violations of the First Amendment or violations of free speech, if we're talking about European countries, for example, that it's really not up to them and should never be up to them to make those kinds of decisions. And I think Kate is absolutely right that they're kind of stuck in the catch-22 in some ways because, you know, they go one way and we get a hearing on the Hill about conservative bias on social media platforms. They go too far the other way and you get other people complaining, right? So it's very difficult to strike that balance. But I think I agree with Kate that regardless of that, the kinds of responses we've seen have not been fully satisfying given how this particular problem has influenced our conversations online, influenced our conversations around really critical democratic events like elections, and not just that. And they've really become, these platforms have really become the number one tools that, you know, authoritarian states can use to try to carry out influence ops against democracies. And I think that's a reality that we're not quite there in terms of facing as to what that really means in practice for the platforms.
I think that's a good way to introduce the sort of another really broad question, which is, to put it bluntly, you know, why does disinformation matter? Fake news has obviously become something that everyone is kind of familiar with as a phrase over the last couple of years. But I think what Alina says gets into this really important point of why people should care. So, Alina, I mean, I'll just throw this back to you. When you talk about how this raises questions about democracy and authoritarian states, what do you mean by that?
Well, I come from the perspective where my concern has primarily been how Russia and also other authoritarian regimes are exploiting these technologies that we thought were going to be a boon for democracy, right? Twitter revolutions, you know, were key during the Arab Spring. They were key during the democratic protests in Ukraine and so many other places. So this was supposed to be a new way for people to express themselves, to hold their governments accountable. And of course, now we're very much in the reverse in many ways, where the dual-use nature of these platforms has really shed light on how these kinds of tools are not just for the use of exclusive use of democratic activists or democratic societies, they can also be exploited by authoritarian regimes. It may not seem like we should care about 1,000 Russian bots or 100 Russian trolls or some pages that the Russian Internet Research Agency, the Troll Farm, set up in St. Petersburg. Why does any of this really matter? But I think over time, to me, it looks like a slow drip. You know, a very slow chipping away at the entire notion that people should trust their institutions, that we should trust our political leaders, that we live in free and fair societies where our voices are heard through a quite structured process of elections, of activism, lawful protests and demonstrations. And that slow drip, you know, one at a time, one troll, one piece of content doesn't really matter. But it's when you take the aggregate and you look at the bigger picture, what you see, what I see, is this ecosystem that we have facilitated of how foreign governments, especially authoritarian governments, are against or that see democracy as a threat to themselves, can really use to over time undermine what I think is a soft spot in democracies, which is trust. And that's really the soft spot they've been pushing on. And I think it's working in some ways. So again, I think if you see, you know, I like to use this metaphor of a symphony orchestra. If you see a violinist playing outside the symphony, it doesn't sound great. They're playing some random notes. It doesn't usually sound like a full melody, right? And that's basically where we are right now. We're looking at, you know, the trolls from Iran, the bots from Russia. But if you put the whole symphony together, you get this, in the case of a symphony orchestra, a beautiful concert. In the case of disinformation, you get this cacophonous concert, if you want to call it that. So again, I think we're in a place now where we're missing the forest before the trees, because in the long term, this will have, I think, quite corrosive effects on our institutions and the nature of our democratic societies.
I think this is such an important point, and I just want to sort of draw it out and clarify. The threat of disinformation is not that some amount of posts changes some amount of votes in particular states, or, you know, swings elections, but is more systemic than that? Is that sort of what you're getting at?
Yeah, I think when we start asking these questions of, you know, did, you know, this particular Russian disinformation campaign, for example, in the 2016 elections, sway a voter in a swing district of Michigan from voting one way or the other? I think that's a question that's impossible to answer, because that's exactly not how these kinds of operations work. And so if we start asking that question, we can say, okay, well, there's no proof that we can definitively point to. It really depends on how you count it, that this mattered in terms of changing the outcome of an election. So it doesn't matter that this happened at all. Let's move on, pay attention to other things. This is something that I would say commonly hear among some people here in Washington. I think that's really the wrong way to think about it. It is, as you said, you know, much more systemic. If we start thinking about these, you know, X causes directly Y, we're never going to really get at the cause of the problem, really understand how it works and why it matters. Because again, it's this slow drip. It's not just one event here, another election there. It's over time, the corrosive effects that these kinds of consistent campaigns and continuous campaigns can have on our societies.
Evelyn, there's a connection here to something that you've written about a fair amount for Lawfare, which is the role that disinformation has played in spreading violence, most notably in Myanmar and other countries. Like this isn't just a sort of airy theoretical concern. I mean, obviously, trust and democracy are very important, but they can sound kind of abstract. But on a more concrete level, there is evidence that this has contributed in people getting hurt.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think it is really important to draw in the international dimensions of this and to understand how decisions that get made with one set of problems in mind can have flow-on and unintended consequences in other situations. And, you know, we were talking earlier about how the words fake news have been co-opted, that they originally meant something very specific about maybe Macedonian teenagers spreading spurious content in America, but then we've seen it get co-opted and adopted by authoritarian regimes around the world to just sort of prevent, to censor opposition or minority activist voices as well. And one of the most striking and horrific examples of this is in Myanmar, where, you know, it was discovered that the military there had these underground bunkers that were working, you know, 24 hours around the clock, spreading disinformation and misinformation about the Rohingya minority. And I think it's sort of overly simplistic, and I don't want to fall into the trap of saying that social media caused the genocide there, because, you know, this is decades of ethnic tension, but it was certainly a big aggravating factor. And so we do need to sort of be aware of the different dynamics in different environments. And when people talk about, for example, platforms being more responsive to government demands to take down inflammatory content, we need to think about how that plays out in other contexts where the government itself is the source of inflammatory content as well.
What I think is fascinating about this issue, as you were just speaking, Evelyn, is how we have all woken up, meaning we in the United States and we in the Democratic West, to this disinformation problem as it's something that's really just affecting us, that's really just about our elections, and that it really is something so new. Of course, it's not, especially if you're looking at Russian activities spanning all the way back to the Soviet era. But I think what's so fascinating is that opened up this whole series of kind of conversations about how these digital platforms are, of course, transnational, international. And so when we are thinking about responses that are inevitably going to be based in specific national parliaments or Congress or various governments, those laws, regulatory fixes, if that's what they are, will have ramifications for the world, you know, and that's huge. And then I think this is just opens up all these legal questions. And I would love to hear, Kate, what you think about all this, because to my mind, I find myself constantly struggling with trying to, or hoping I had a legal background, because all these legal questions about free speech and content and setting a precedent. So if we pass a law in the United States, how will it be abused or used as justification for a really repressive policy, perhaps in a place like Russia, a place like China, or a place like Singapore? I feel like I still can't really fully wrap my mind around it.
That's a fantastic question. And I think that one of the things I think is really important is that when you're talking about how these platforms take down information is that you remember that when Thailand passes a law for Thailand about speech, it's not affecting necessarily the takedown of that information in a place like the United States. So they'll take down something in Thailand about the king that is disparaging, but that content would still appear in Tennessee, for example. So that's one answer to your point, Alina. But the other thing that I really think is fascinating right now is these demands to kind of concede to government requests for takedown, that governments get to decide these types of things, and these platforms have to agree with them. And so one of the things that I've been writing about in the last couple of weeks and months is a lot of the requests and the movements happening in Europe to not have things just geo-blocked within Europe, as I just described, it would happen with the Thai king, for example, but to instead have that rule enforced extraterritorially, which I think is the worst of all possible worlds. It's basically governments that are particularly strong and have a particularly strong market base kind of putting these private platforms over a barrel, more or less, and co-opting them to make them conform all of their global rules to that particular country's norms. And I think that that's incredibly dangerous. And there's very little way to push back on that if the private companies don't do this. So I have plenty of problems with all of these private companies. But one of the things that you never hear about is how they have been fighting in the courts. A lot of these free speech battles since the 2000s, like this is from the early 2000s, to try to push back on requests for takedown from a lot of governments around the world.
Yeah, and it's another way in which, a fascinating way in which all of this has flipped, because one of the original promises and hopes for the internet was this borderless world, this sort of seamless information environment that connected us all instantaneously. And now we're in this environment where it's like, no, borders, borders, please, borders and friction. Like maybe that might be an answer to some of the problems that we've been having. So it's just this kind of complete reversal of the original sort of libertarian utopian vision of the internet.
Completely. I think that having the international discussion is so important, because how these things affect different countries and people, like misinformation, disinformation affect people, has so much to do with how much rule of law exists in your country when things start out. If there is a very strong rule of law, I don't think that fake news, disinformation, misinformation is as great a threat. I know that's going to be a controversial thing to say, but with, like, you're in Myanmar, if you're in a lot of places in the global south, and you don't have, you can't trust that a mob isn't going to come after you. This is kind of tagging on to what you said, Evelyn, about kind of the violence that gets stirred up by fake news. But I think that one of the things that really distinguishes it is like the fact that you can trust that you can call the police and like someone will come, or that there will be, you know, a really good newspaper that eventually susses out what happened, whether or not it's immediately or later. And if you don't have those types of things, this is still the wild, wild west. And that's why I think there's been this call for friction and everything else.
I think there's a lot to that, but the difficulty is as well that you don't want to get into an environment where these private American companies are in the business of evaluating how much rule of law a country has. And sort of, you know, I totally agree with what you're saying, but there's also sort of this, how do you implement that without some sort of parochialism or notions of like, oh, well, you guys can have the internet, but you guys can't have the internet, that kind of problem as well.
So just to follow on the controversial line a little bit about saying things that might be controversial. So the companies, of course, and also some legislative efforts, especially in Europe, have really been focusing on this idea of content moderation, right? How do you get these companies to commit to taking down, let's say, violent content, hate speech, things that are much more obvious, but they've sort of gone into these murky territories of harmful speech without really having a clear definition about it. And so I've been increasingly convinced that this whole idea of content moderation as the solution to all of our problems is completely broken and it's smoke and mirrors. But of course, this is where we are right now in the conversation because it brings up all these legal questions about, you know, free speech, the Constitution of the United States. And I think some of the other issues that I find, you know, a bit more controversial is, you know, what about looking at these companies that we haven't quite defined yet? You know, they're not media companies, they're not publishers, you know, they're not your general kind of Microsoft or IBM style tech company. You know, what are they, right? And maybe we can avoid that question and start to think about, well, you know, we've regulated in the United States and certainly in Europe huge industries that were basically in the wild, wild west for decades, like the tobacco industry, you know, like the banking sector, who were exploiting people and, yes, publishing false information in the case of the tobacco industry about the harms of smoking. Can we look at some of these precedents to think through how to rein in some of the harms coming from these companies? But I think the big question is, how do we do that while still maintaining some, I guess, sense of control, this question of borders. Do we want these borders? Because, you know, we regulate Facebook, you know, in Russia, Vkontakte will pop up as the dominant social media platform, right? We have no control over what they're doing.
I think you're absolutely right that there is a lot to be learned from sort of regulating harmful things in other domains, but there's something about this that just makes it so special and so difficult, is that you can't regulate speech in the way that you can regulate anything else, because government intervention is just so much more fraught and potentially pernicious. And so it sort of makes this really difficult tension of how do you sort of implement sort of banking or tobacco regulation in the realm of political speech, which it just makes it sort of all the more fun for us, but less fun ultimately. And I mean, I also completely agree with you that content moderation in so many ways is broken, and there needs to be a lot of sort of development and work on this. But I don't know. I mean, I'm going to throw this to Kate. I kind of have the view that it's also probably an indispensable part of the solution as well, because the scale at which this kind of stuff is happening, that is that companies inevitably are going to have to play a role in shaping information environment. It can't be outsourced away from those sort of frontline actors. But I don't know, Kate, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I was just going to say, I was like, Alina, it's okay that you don't believe in content moderation, because I like kind of don't think that disinformation is all that big a deal.
The truth comes out.
As long as we're going to be throwing controversial things. No, and I'm just kidding. A lot of times in debates about fake news, where there's kind of like this like panic of just throwing our skirts over our heads and running around and being like, disinformation and fake news is going to end democracy. And I think it's a problem, but I think it's a little bit a symptom of a norm shifting and a norm forming moment that we're having in our society with the internet and changes in information technology and changes in friction, as Evelyn brought up, and things like that. But that's not to say that I can't be convinced otherwise, and that's not going to be a big deal. But I completely agree with Evelyn. I think that there's something that happens with the new way that information is spread and information is shared that makes it so that there's never an easy answer anymore to kind of epistemological questions, to even not epistemological questions, just pure kind of event, what happened at XYZ moment in time and place. And so I think that those end up kind of, if we don't have some type of oversight to that, that we're in a problem. And I think that what Evelyn and I both kind of think is the best of possible solutions is some type of more accountable, more democratic board or governance structure that actually takes users' interests directly into account. That's basically the future of solution to this has to integrate content moderation in some way. I think that's a great way of putting it, Evelyn. It doesn't necessarily have to be the solution, but definitely it's going to be a part of the solution.
So, I mean, one thing that obviously it's not just about, you know, foreign actors who are trying to influence our democracies or specific events to their advantage in the geopolitical chess game. And it's not just about the social media platform. It's not just about the users, and it's not just about government responses, right? They were not going to have, you know, the one solution. We're not going to have a silver bullet here. It's going to take, I think, a combination of all of these different actors in this space, trying new things until we kind of get to a place where we set up the norms, the institutions, the rules, guidelines that will get our societies to a place where we can function in a digital age. Because I think that one thing that I often remind myself is that, and we are still undergoing the digital revolution. It's not like pop, these new platforms emerge and now we're in the post-platform age. No, we're still in this growth period, and they're really young companies, right? For many young people, right, who grow up completely connected to the internet, it seems like these things have been around forever. They can't imagine a world without them. But they've only been around for about 15 years, right? And I think it's totally understandable and normal that's taking a while for all of us to catch up, right? And to try to really grasp the legal, the societal, even the economic, the political implications of what we're still going through. And I am actually pretty optimistic that we'll get there. But I think what this conversation points to is that it's going to take efforts in all these different domains that hopefully over time will coalesce into some beautiful concert versus a gross cacophony.
I think that's also, that goes back to sort of why we're doing this podcast right now, right? Which is to take a, you know, parochial American view. In the United States, there is the 2020 presidential election coming up. And we've already seen hints of the role that disinformation might play in that. I think the most notorious thing early in the summer of 2019 was a sort of doctored video of Nancy Pelosi apparently speaking slowly, slurring her speech a little bit. And the president picked it up. It got a lot of mileage. And that's kind of, you know, a little bit of a taste maybe of what we're seeing in 2020. And so from my perspective, as someone who's paying close attention to how the president in particular interacts with disinformation and how that affects sort of general questions of, as Alina said, trust and rule of law, the 2020 election and the run-up to the election is going to be a really, really important testing ground for everything that we're talking about here. That doesn't mean, you know, that we only have one chance to get it right. We're going to see in a trial by fire what works and doesn't work. And for that reason, the next, you know, 12 months are just going to be a really interesting time to watch this space.
Going back to what Alina was saying as well is that, you know, we're going to need responses on so many different fronts to all of this kind of thing. There's so much interesting and fascinating research happening in so many different fields. And so hopefully that's one of the things that we can unpack over the course of this podcast is reasons for optimism about the great work that is being done coming at this from different angles.
And in terms of context, it's not just our elections, of course. What's interesting is European governments, especially the EU, have really taken a leading role in trying to frame some sort of regulatory options. Some misguided, perhaps we could talk about that. But the new European Commission, which is just coming into form over the summer and in the spring, seems intent to do much, much more. And so tracking what that will mean, again, it's not just going to be contained to Europe and European shores. That will have profound effects on how these companies do business elsewhere, including the United States, and what that will mean for 2020, I think is something that's absolutely interesting and critical to explore, including the fact that, you know, our own government in the United States has pretty much done nothing. And so talking about the reasons for that and what that means for the bigger global issue is also something that I think over the next year is going to be incredibly interesting and relevant.
Kate, I'll leave it to you for the closing thought.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I talk about a lot when I talk about some panels and stuff is what I've kind of said earlier, which was that we're in this norm setting period. And I think that there's a lot to be seen, and that we expect all these platforms, we expect ourselves, we expect our governments to react really quickly to this incredibly new technology and this incredibly new form of manipulation. This is something that I think that we're just going to get better with in time. I think we already are. So one of the examples that I really give is that after 2016, people were talking about fake news, and that was everyone's concern. And people just didn't know how to talk about it. People didn't know how to look for it. And while I think the panic over fake news ended up being kind of a little overblown at that point and a little confused, I do think that it served as this kind of public service announcement in which people went out and kind of, there was a sense that, you know, you didn't want to be the one spreading fake news on your Facebook, and people would fact check each other when someone posted something. And there was a knowledge that fake news existed, and it actually ended up becoming, I think, kind of a good thing ultimately. And so I think for there's a lot of ways in which we're still figuring out how all of this is going to work and what it's going to do. But I think that that's a great example of just in the span of 2 to 3 years, a lot of the world has come to recognize what content moderation is. People have become cautious of fake news, and then we're talking about it. And yeah, so I guess that is an optimistic note to end on, that this is, if we remind ourselves that this is a process and are wise about how we construct a response to it, is probably really the most that we can do right now.
All right. Well, let's end on that cheerful note after a podcast full of doom and gloom. Thanks so much, everybody. We'll look forward to talking to you guys in the coming weeks. Thanks for listening to the first episode of Arbiters of Truth. We have some great episodes lined up. In the next few weeks, you'll be hearing from David Kay, the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression, about how social media companies have become global speech police and why it's important to remember international concerns and domestic debates. We'll also talk to Daphne Keller, the Director of Intermediary Liability at Stanford Center for Internet and Society, and the former Assistant General Counsel at Google, about what she wishes everyone knew about the laws that hold platforms liable for the speech of their users, and whether a court in the European Union just broke the internet. And we'll be talking to Zoe Darmé, manager of the Facebook team setting up the platform's new oversight board on content moderation. These guests and more are coming up on Lawfare's Arbiters of Truth series heading into 2020. The Lawfare podcast is a production of the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, and this podcast is edited and produced by Jen Patya Howell. Thanks also to Michaela Fogel and Jacob Schulz for audio engineering. Please take the time to rate and review the Lawfare podcast in iTunes or whatever app you use. And as always, thanks for listening.